You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 LPFM. My name is Steve Niebel, and I'm your host today. I'm sitting in for David Gilmore, who is on hiatus. Today we have Michael Daly. Cervena Barva Press in Somerville, Massachusetts, is expected to publish his poetry collection, True Hercules, and Don Madres will publish This Is How Good You Are, New and Selected Poems. So welcome, Michael Daly.
Well, this is a recent poem in memory of my good friend, Jerry Gorslin, who died this year. I was one of the founding members of Empty Bowl, and so was Jerry, along with Tim McNulty, Finn Wilcox, Tom Jay, Sharon Dubiago. We began this press that I now pretty much am the publisher for. It started because several of us, well, Michael Connor, I forgot to mention too, Michael Connor, Finn Wilcox, Tim McNulty, Jerry Gorslin, and myself were tree planters in the Pacific Northwest. On the Olympic Peninsula and the Cascades, we planted trees in a company called Olympic Reforestation. Jerry, who was an avid botanist and devotee of the Pacific Northwest, and was one day showing us this beautiful flower. The memory of him showing it to me came to mind just a little while ago this spring when some people I didn't know were pointing out the Calypso bulbosa on our trail, the trail that we usually walk on near our house. So this is called Finding My Guides to Calypso Bulbosa for Jeremiah Gorslin, 1940 to 2021. I was as if snatched up in an owl's memory when they spoke of the wild orchid and dropped in a high meadow back to the day the crew circled as Jerry, down on one knee, Calypso's droopy bell leaning on his fingertip, extolled the sexed delicacy of its incarnadine organs, thin as the veil draped off the shoulder of a divinity's concubine. More than his usual red-headed fairness, his face glowed, and, unmindful of us, he blushed like a man in love, as the rest of us, our gear on the trail up a rock-faced mud slope to scramble thousands of fir seedlings down into torched slash, awaited while he effused on her orchid rarity, her year-in, year-out eternity, undetected, constant as a church bell, evanescence, then and there under his lightest touch. We all stood around, heavy-booted, with the hope, just once, if ever, to feel aroused to such reverence for this fairy slipper orchid with its solitary, nodding, and strikingly beautiful flower.
It's like you all were a little bit envious of his ability to appreciate such a beautiful thing.
I've never seen anybody get so excited about a flower. It just kind of amazed me. And I think the memory of Jerry's love for that particular plant has always stayed with me that one day. And I think that's the way he felt about most things that he'd really get excited about. And a lot of people do. And yeah, so we all kind of, we all either thought, oh, this is amazing, or, okay, let's just get back to work. You know, we're probably had mixed feelings about all of that.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, you were in the forest all day long, and you saw a lot of different...
We were in clear cuts all day long.
Well, Well, okay, I'll give you that. You know, you are in clear cut, but you probably walked through a forest to get there and through a forest to get out of there. And even clear cuts, you know, they still have... So these were fresh clear cuts.
Yeah.
Like all torn up from the heavy machinery of logging.
Yeah, hundreds of acres. Yeah. I remember once we were out by Nia Bay, I think, pretty far at the farthest northwestern tip of the lower 48. And it must have been an election year because I thought they should have the inaugural ceremony at a clear cut. That would really... impress people in America to see what's going on.
The truth is that Americans would probably be pretty oblivious of the experience. They wouldn't understand what was going on there unless you gave them a very clear explanation.
Yeah, right. What's the connection between this and the toilet paper you use?
Right. It was probably lumber timber that had been logged there. Toilet paper is usually made out of alder or cottonwood or something like one of those deciduous trees, right?
Oh, right. Well, yeah, this was Crown Zellerbach, usually. That was the first company that we worked for. And I think that, I don't know, I thought they were making paper bags at the time, chopping bags, and they were pretty big. But yeah, you're right. It's probably mostly... Well, it would depend on the size of trees that we're cutting, I suppose, what kind of lumber they can get out of it. Most of the time when we saw trees down, they weren't very big, really, and maybe 30 years old or so.
Well, it doesn't take a big tree to make a paper, that's for sure. Well, let's merrily roll along.
Okay, sure.
This is kind of fun going through... all these different places.
Well, here's two little ones I'd like to read since
we're
about the Northwest. The title is kind of long. For my laid off neighbor whom machined devices still employed on the moon. What do three geese awakening anxious sleepers with this honk and wing stroke toward? Down the valley to the lake. Industrious geese, through arms of fur, they descend a ridgetop bloom of sunlight. I want to stay home. Plenty of geese. More tomorrow. That's another one that's very, very old. It's probably maybe 30 years old. When a lot of people were out of work, it would have been in the 90s. And this other one, coyotes on the way to somewhere else. I just remember we used to hear more coyotes than we have in this past year or so. But several years ago, probably again in the 90s or maybe sometime before 2010, I just remember waking up in the middle of the night and stepping outside on my porch, and I heard these coyotes just kind of going crazy, kind of down in an alley down below my house. It struck me as a kind of an oral rendition of what Mark Tobey was doing with white writing and other famous Northwest artists. So I have a little... epigraph from Mark Tobey at the beginning of this. The name of the poem is Coyotes on the Way to Somewhere Else. A few streaks of white, some blue streaks, looked like a distorted nest. It bothered me, Mark Tobey. White writing streaks a pitch black backdrop, moonless mid-September nights, like clockwork after 10. A tangled net of song, stitched thread of dappled tones. Perhaps they're down among the poplars, where a curling creek emerges, and in March bloated frogs boast. Once I heard them cackle there at 4 a.m., a tribe passing through the pasture, laughing all the way to somewhere else, shy version of creator, recurrent as grass, shotgun useless against sound dancing, firefly dervish that happy. So there's two short poems set here in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. Coyotes always interesting to me, that they're one of those creatures that always survive, and they're everywhere. People talk about spotting coyotes here in the city, and in certain parts of the country, they're even more common. Of course, out where you live, I'm sure you see a coyote now and then, but they do a pretty good job of hiding, don't they?
Yeah, I still hear them every now and then. We used to actually see them more around here. Years ago, I remember watching a couple of coyote emerge from the woods chasing a couple of deer, or looking after a couple of deer. And they saw me on the porch and they turned around and went the other direction. Yeah, I think they've become kind of an urban animal in a lot of ways.
So let's go on to another poem.
Okay. You know, I mentioned that I used to live in Fort Townsend. Actually, I'd like to read two haibuns, the Japanese form that is part prose and closes with a haiku. So I took liberties with the haiku part in this book of a feather. There are six haibuns, and I want to read the first and the last one. Years ago, somebody mentioned that my poetry or my consciousness is deeply bicoastal, and that's always stuck with me. Deeply bicoastal, I like it, because I can't be in the Pacific Northwest and get New England out of my mind. I can't be in New England and get the Pacific Northwest out of my mind. So I imagine that's true. So this first one is called New England Hawks in October. On a windy day here in Hull, a small hawk perched on the seawall, and because it watched me coming close, I thought it was injured or even poisoned. I approached slowly, its head turned toward me, eyes clicking on my every move. Eyes of a predator, that hawk studied me with patience and eagerness. When I held out a stick to see if it would take hold, it stepped back, the sharp eyes focused on me, 3 feet away. It was then I realized those talons might rip off my face and that pale green beak could grind my eyeball. I stepped over the seawall where whitecaps barreled from Boston Light. When I turned again, the hawk was in flight, wide wingspan, coasting over sailboats at anchor. It appeared to be a kestrel or a sparrowhawk clinging to a concrete seawall. Heavy wind. A few days before, a much larger hawk, a redtail, clung to the verdigris spire of the Greek Orthodox Church beside my sister's house, its mate most probably nesting in the woodlot across the street. Yesterday evening, a Swanson's hawk alighted on the dead branch of an elm in the yard. I've been reading Thoreau's Cape Cod Journal. And remember, it starts right here, weathering the wild. That is, he came through Hull, and then caught up with the shipwreck in Cohasset, Irish immigrant corpses all along the stormy beach. Our house was once a railway stop. In my imagination, old Henry David trudges up the hillside to start his long trek down the Cape. I'd like to be a good observer and learn from his books. But when I see this hawk, I can't help myself, and my 3 steps across the grass are enough for it to drop down and swoop across our little avenue, where it hides now, for all I know, in the neighbor's tall hedges, already inflamed as the famous trees here do these crisp weeks. Why write? Why else, each day, does the hawk fall to its fierce grass? A clear and sullen line, talons stabbing once, aim true as desire. So the haibun form is supposed to be this prose piece with a haiku that echoes it. As I said, I kind of took liberties with the haiku form. This haiku is, there's no syllable count. It's not the 5-7-5 that we're often told is the format for a haiku. And I've taught the haiku form to my students. I always said, well, in American, it's a little bit different than it is in Japanese, of course, the counting of the syllables, so that you can, we usually use more syllables in our expressions. So I took liberties there by using too many syllables. And in this next one, Evening in Port Townsend, 1977, my haiku was only 5 words. Evening in Port Townsend, 1977. I'm in a box. You can't even tell what's in it. Heaved up by 2 centuries of bricklayers. Except for the lives gone past, like jeweled glitter in the marina at the tips of creaking masts, the brindled deck rails of yachts, berthed and canopied under the galaxy with its unthinkable black hole. Mountains unfold and fold again, dimpled unwavering snow light and grades of gray, of blue. The mill's white fluff butters the air. Sandy bluffs fade and tilt backward from the sun. TV antennae and prongs of hemlock up where houses picket the skyline. Pilings dot the muck. Gull stolen and parchment thin crab hovels, whistling sea air, cracked on rocks and surface water, smear low tide. The ferry, a passage of spirits entranced on engine throb, distant ghost islands in the mist, white pocked houses and cupolas, and the day's light at 7:53 going down is a long strip of vanilla yellow jiggy over the slightest of waves. One sailboat, mainsail luffing, another becalmed. Shadows throughout town flow up the bluffs and rise into the streets. Morgan Hill, a cap of fir spikes. Old, aghast buildings, mortar fragile as paper, a paper town, the hundreds of windows bright lit and going dark on all the 3rd, 4th, and 5th floors where secrets I know and you don't reek like a drunk forgetting and reshaping what happened before today, which is nothing new, although the sun might pass over the Cascades only one more time. Parking lot lights go on.
Wow.
A deeply bicoastal experience.
That had a very strong East Coast feeling to me. I'm not sure. It was the description of the houses that were, what was it, they were paper?
Well, paper town, yeah.
Paper town, and that seemed like, I wasn't sure what you meant by that.
I guess in a sense, well, for one thing, there is a paper mill in Port Townsend.
Of course.
Employs almost everybody, employs a large portion of the population. But at that time, in 1977, I guess kind of looking at those buildings in a town like Port Townsend, those old brick buildings, which then were mostly empty or uninhabited on the upper floors. And I think now, since then, I think in Port Townsend, they've restored and remodeled most of those old buildings. But at that time, that sense of being in a place where you were surrounded by history that was really fragile, that was in a sense ghostly because of the empty rooms, I suppose, is what stood out to me. But where, you know, bricks and mortar really weren't holding it all together very, very well. So that was my sense, I think, when I was trying to get that image across. But I can't really say, because that was 1977 when I wrote that. So I'm not going to go back to my personality then and say, oh, this is what I meant.
So what's it like being a publisher, and you do some editing for when you're publishing people, or do they get somebody else to do their editing, or how does that work?
A little of both, yeah. I don't do a lot of editing for poetry. I sometimes do more editing for authors who have prose that they like to publish. But copy editing, of course, is a large part of that. Usually I'll copy edit a manuscript before sending it on to an actual experienced copy editor and just try to catch whatever I can, you know, in each document. But I think that, you know, a lot of the the processes that I get involved with are really the mechanical aspects of publishing books, reading in order to either accept or reject a manuscript, to suggest changes, which often are not very many, and then moving the book along to, like I said, a copy editor, a book designer, eventually the printer, and then the distributor, and to use other methods to promote the book on online, typically the Empty Bowl website. Magnificat is a poem to the memory of Bill Evans, the famous jazz pianist, and for Stephanie, who is my friend who introduced me to the work of Bill Evans. Magnificat. My friend, my soul tonight is sleeping in western Massachusetts, and I know where. On the road, the turn the headlights miss. My soul is buried among the twigs of oak, forgotten by the oak, pebbles frozen onto tar, among dozens and dozens of scribbles in the bits of falling that build, sullen from a wing, a bird of night, these white, eternal chips that disappear. Apparitions of women saving embers in a cup, riding in the land of riders, their ghosted hair lost in the stars above the country. In Minnesota or Wisconsin, a woman froze beside her car, her pulse 3 beats to the minute. She was ordinary secretary reciting ice in her lavender sleep. Tonight, on my gleaming Juan de Fuca, I think about my soul. 1,000 landscapes I have ridden, the eyes of our patriarchs worn with cares, faces all the time grinning. Outside, the cold quarter of the last moon of winter sets a pattern of white cups onto the waves. Broken master strokes an artist yearns for, envious of the puddle of moon at his feet, so well made and so uncanny he steps over, taking it for a stone. Mornings, pianissimos of small waves fall into the window, a white moth, small as soot, flies to the bark of a wet stump. The trembling wingtip reminds me of your fingers the last time I saw you. Seabirds scrape our ears with dry hunger, drop crabs to die, and I, although I know so little, hope to praise and to magnify, just as a key in a pool of rain becomes twice its size. Our clothes still have the smell of bars. With the first coffee, we begin to forget and then ignore and refill our cups with disappointment. Listen, was that my name in the mouth of a child at the foot of the stair? Was it two sharp notes, or your name somehow buried on the air? More of you remains in two of your lucky notes than is here of me. I, who am some cloth being worn by a man, have these little burstings of music like many beautiful hammers chasing hope out of diamonds. They are idiosyncrasies of the born. Not dead, a square of plaid blowing in the street. Yes, we will meet again. This evening, in the drizzle, 6 whales rose and fell on the straits. I watched from the porch until dinner. Then the president came on the radio and rained through my disgorgement over all the world. Even this was our country. The sadness of the winding moon, the sentences that wouldn't let me sleep, The eagle who stared at me today flew hungrily down the breadth of coast, out of sight of the rich who have not yet been sent empty away. Even to be born now, ignorant of the other worlds, even to raise no hand against the tyrant of history, even to see the adversaries scatter like meaningless utterings of the proud, even to be born at the evening of this moment would be better than to not exist. Imagine to never have tasted this air, not to have known our seed that is a promise forever. I half wake up and open the window on the raining silver that blackens beside my dream. I have found a room above the attic. Someone with a wisp of gray on his coat is playing an old New Orleans tune, who, when I approach, lifts his finger from the last note. While in the surf, a tide of bravos is throwing itself at the stones. So that's the last poem in my first book, The Straits, published a long time ago, 1983.
Right. It seems to go a lot of different places in it and stay in the same place at the same time.
Yeah, I think so. I guess I have the attitude that I approach some poems with the idea of a form already. Sometimes the form of a sonnet, for instance, or the form of a haiku or something like that. And then there are times also when I know that I have something to write that is formless, is intentionally formless. That is, the form is going to find itself on the page as I write it. And I think that's one of those poems. It was one of the first times for me that I realized that a poem that I started to use a very, very short line. I picked it up from reading a poem called Dead Letter by Sam Hamill years ago. I think it was one of the, you know, as I was learning something about poetry, I would read other poets, and I knew Sam at the time, and he gave me a copy of this little chapbook that he had printed at Copper Canyon Press. And it was in this long strip of very, very short lines, very few syllables per line. And I think that kind of influenced me to create a kind of a form for Magnificat. Not that it's an imitation, but that I realized for the first time that you can have lines of poetry that don't need to fill the page. The title Magnificat comes from a hymn in the New Testament, and I actually took some of the lines, for instance, the line about the tyrant and the rich shall be sent empty away. Those are all lines from that poem or hymn in the New Testament, and so I could see that, you know, there was a kind of a political turn there, and I brought in the president to sort of bring that up to date in a way, contemporaneously.
Well, Michael, why don't you pick out one more, and let's go ahead and do that, and then we'll wrap up today.
Okay, well, this is an East Coast poem. It's a fairly new poem about a time in my life that will always affect me. When people have accidents on the road, car accidents, it never leaves. This is called Leaving the Wreck, and starts with an epigraph, a quotation from Thomas Tranströmer. One evening in February, I almost died here, Thomas Tranströmer. Right here, at 21, I should have been killed in the harsh September rain, the trooper said. But I walked away. The crushed steel embrace that was my first car rushed up that hump where Route 3 joins 128. Her tires sluiced across three lanes, and northbound drivers ricocheted in the Boston downpour. Inside the beige V-dub, the hiss of rain, mortal silence, a shopping mall flows across the windshield. The stem of worlds twists like a clock backward. I went still. The metal clanged, the body jolted, tail end crushed sideways. All those angry hammers. I was in the way. Afterward, dropped at a phone booth. It was 1968. I fell into a long sleep, the falling through the ice dream, and awakening to tell my survivor's tale, I convinced myself a grain of sand rescued my wheel for a purpose. The next 35 years flew past. Another trooper talking. She's dead. You're the victim. Brakes locked. Steering froze. That was me. I took her life. That's why I was born. Delusional? Yes. She appears to me in trees. Heart Lake, the old growth, hundreds of years without a word. My family's entire history huddles inside these uncorrupted bodies. I find her here. Wind and fire take down a grand elder, but not her. Roots, splay, ferns, needles, and a yellow muck like last summer's blaze did to Sequoia, a recognition. That moment we can never meet. Stillness doesn't take us away. In a silence without stopping, our wheels scour the planet. I know that's a tough poem to end on, but it's a poem that's very important to me.
The sequoias was something that just happened last summer, right?
Right, yeah.
And you were recalling. There were two wrecks in this, right?
Right, yeah. My first car was totaled, and I was pretty young. And, I guess I should have died the way it was hit, from what I was told. In 2003, I was in an accident. I was the driver, and someone was killed.
Do you ever wonder how you survived to get so old?
Well, you know, there was that period in the 70s where I think a lot of people had the idea that I'll never get 50. It's impossible. 40? No. You know, don't trust anybody over 30. All those kinds of things. And yeah, I never really thought that I would live to be in my 70s. But
here you are.
When I turned 70, I'll be 75 this next year. But when I turned 70, I realized that, my main feeling is gratitude. I knew an awful lot of people who didn't get to see 70, died of disease and heart failure and drug overdoses and all kinds of things, and even in the war. And, I'm one of those people who has managed to see this decade. I'm very grateful for it. I'm very grateful for all the friends I have who have also come along through life.
Which books would you like to have mentioned?
There's two forthcoming. The one is the novel Telemachus. It'll be out by March from Pleasure Boat Studio. The other is called Reinhabited, New and Selected Poems, coming out from Dos Madres Press in Ohio.
And where will people be able to get those?
Those books are available from the publishers. They Dos Madres and Pleasure Boat Studio have websites. They're available on Amazon. Anybody who goes to a local bookstore and asks for those titles, the bookstores can order them from their distributor.
Okay. Thank you for being on Sound Poetry today. I'm Steve Niebel, sitting in for David Gilmore, and we've been listening to Michael Daly, an anachordist poet, the publisher of Empty Bowl Press. Thanks a lot, Michael, for doing this with us.
Well, thank you very much.